Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Okay, music fans, this one is for you. Who out there does not like this jam? Okay, so maybe you're more of a breeze rock kind of person. It's hard for me to say I'm sorry. I just want you to stay. After all that we've been through. Okay. Now there's no way you haven't heard this one. What you may or may not know is that all of these songs were produced by the same man, composer, arranger, and producer David Foster. Foster's been playing music since he was a kid, growing up in Canada, and by the time he was a teenager, he was playing backup for Chuck Berry. He's been a music industry powerhouse behind not only the artists you just heard, Earth, Wind & Fire, Chicago, and Whitney, he also touts Barbra Streisand, Celine Dion, and Josh Groban as collaborators. Among his many accolades, he has 16 Grammys, because he's been nominated for Academy Awards. He isn't too shy to say he's got his eye on a Tony eventually. He's going for the EGOT. The new documentary, David Foster, Off the Record, which begins streaming today, chronicles his hugely successful career while also reconciling how his ambition affected his personal life. And of course, there's lots and lots of music. It's directed by Barry Averich, fellow Canadian, and the filmmaker behind the films The Last Mogul and Prosecuting Evil. And I'm pleased to welcome both David. Hi, David.
Hi, Allison.
And hi, Barry.
Hi, Allison. Good morning.
So, Barry, I watched a talk you gave where you pitched. You said one of your mantras is anyone will meet you. But it really is all about the pitch once you meet somebody. So what was your pitch for this film?
Well, you know, thank you, first of all, for playing that music at the top of the segment, because it took me right back to our world premiere at the Toronto Film Festival. David and I were sitting together, and every time a piece of music came on, the audience would go, oh, they remembered, and they sort of got lost in it, and was sort of affirmation to me, not to David, because he knows the brilliance of his work, but to me to just let the audience get lost in the film. And so, I was shocked that there was no, when this was brought to me, that no documentary had been made about David. I mean, this is, it's Quincy Jones and David Foster. There's no one else in the industry as far as I'm concerned. And so, David and I began a long discussion about how we'd approach it and how I would approach it. But he kind of had me at hello, because I grew up with all of that music, and I will listen to it forever.
So, David, what was it about Barry's approach that made you want to be involved? I'm sure you've been approached before.
Well, actually, the fact is I have not been approached before, so I don't know if that speaks to Barry or not, but, you know, Barry's so convincing, such a solid filmmaker is not the word. He's such an expert at making documentaries. And the first thing I did was watch his documentary, The Last Mogul, which was brilliant. And I kind of was had at hello, too, because nobody had ever approached me before. And then I got approached with just such high-end people, with Barry and Bell Media, Randy Lennox and Jeffrey Latimer and you know, just quality people. I knew it would be great, even if I wasn't great in it.
That is shocking that no one ever approached David before. So, Barry, the movie starts off with David kind of explaining to you, you know, he might micromanage you, and the movie ends with him trying to micromanage you and tell you it's over. What was the working dynamic between the two of you, Barry?
Well, ultimately pretty great. I mean, you know, keep in mind, before David and I met in California, and we got introduced over a couple of meetings that took place in L.A. and New York. He didn't know me. I certainly knew of him. We'd never worked together. So we had to, you know, I felt that I had to, you know, 50 documentaries in, prove myself to him, and that's okay. I mean, there's no diva or pretentiousness here. And David got to see me work with the cameras when we were covering one of his concerts, but it wasn't until we sat down at Capitol Records to do the first master interview where I saw the, you know, the layers of the onion start to peel away and
fall apart.
And he trusted not fall apart, but trust me with, you know, in giving me the access to him. And occasionally he would say to me, you know, why are you obsessed with this? Why you keep pushing this? And but to his credit, he stayed the course. He'll tell you himself, he knew the rules to make this a really good film. And what you should know is that the film that we premiered in Toronto at the film festival last September, we ultimately changed, you know, quite substantially for this Netflix premiere, because both David and I felt there were some uncovered territory. And again, to his credit, he said, you know what, Barry, bring the crew out. Let's go at it again. And we did. We spent another 5 hours, you know, going into some uncomfortable territory for him, and it makes it a better film. And I adore him. I mean, I can't say that about a lot of the subjects of my documentaries. He is a complex man, extraordinarily talented, generous, tough, and, you know, a true Renaissance human being.
David, what did you want to come back and explore further?
And thank you for that, Barry, by the way. Well, I've only seen the film twice, once each version. And after I watched it at Toronto, of course, it was, you know, kind of humbling to see all that and see what a great job Barry had done and to watch it all unfold in 93 minutes. But I felt that we could go deeper into my psyche. And in, like Barry said, the proper way to make a documentary is you don't get involved. When I make music, it's not a democracy. I want to have control of everything I do in the studio, and that's when I do my best work. And I allowed Barry to have the same freedom. And that was the only way I thought that we could. I wanted to see myself through his lens. So I didn't really get involved. I mean, we had maybe one or two little arguments, but basically he made the film he wanted to make. And I said, you know, have another go at me. And you want to drill down about my children, you want to drill down about what makes me, you know, why I did this, why I did that. And he had a five-hour go at me again, and that's the new version of the film.
David, what did you learn about yourself through this process?
Well, I know, you know, every story that I told, I know, and I knew intimately, you know, you for yourself, Allison, or anybody, any human on the planet, we all know our own story intimately. We're the writer and director and producer and star of our own life, right? So every story I knew, of course, but then when he started asking me some tough questions, like, well, why, you know, why did you get married this time? Why did you not speak with that daughter for 2 years? Why, you know, things like that. Those are the uncomfortable subjects.
And did you?
You know, it's interesting, Allison. The first time we sat down to shoot, I had just filmed one of David's daughters, and it was raw. And I came back and I told David about that, and you know, and his first reaction was, I have other daughters. You got to hear everybody's story. And, you know, don't get so caught up in one story. And, you know, at first I was like, well, what the hell does that mean on that end of it? But it's true. I mean, you know, he has imparted his DNA, his complex DNA, in such a diverse way through all of these kids. And they're all so different that he's right. I did have to speak to all of them to get a sense of their relationships with David.
My guests are Barry Averich and David Foster. We're talking about the new documentary, David Foster, Off the Record. So we learn a lot about you, David, and your childhood, and that you've had perfect pitch since you were a kid. So how did that impact, what impact did that have on the way you work and the way you developed as a musician?
Well, I think, you know, it is something you're born with. It's not something that you can learn. And so I think it's an indicator that you probably should do music for your life if you are born with perfect pitch. Of course, there's probably many people out there that have it that don't know they have it because they didn't pursue music. But it's both a curse and a blessing, and it would take too long to explain it. But basically, when I hear a note anywhere, I know what note it is. And that's great, but it's also a curse for reasons that are just too complicated or too long an explanation. But I will say this. Now that I've gotten older, I've lost my perfect pitch. And I've talked to other people that have perfect pitch, and the same thing happened to them. So it's sort of like a muscle or a some kind of memory thing. And as you get older and forget things, one of them is perfect pitch. So from going from 100% right my entire life to about 10 years ago, being 90% right to 80%, and then sort of hit and miss lately. Weird.
Do you miss it? Do you miss not having it?
No, it's just confusing not to have it, because if you were told your whole life that this color is pink, your whole life, no matter what happened, you look at pink and it's pink, and then all of a sudden you're told, no, that's blue. That's kind of embarrassing.
You describe repeatedly in the film the moment when you hear a singer or a voice that just has that something special, that distinct, that X factor, and that your whole, everything else gets blocked out, and that it just becomes the focus on them, and you hear kind of an internal voice telling you, yes, this is it. What does that sound like? What does that feel like for you?
Well, it's like the, I think I described it in the documentary, it's like in the movies, everything goes, and then all of a sudden, you know, all the outside external noises are gone, and you just hear that voice. But I would say to you that, you know, people say, wow, you're great at, like, discovering talent, and I haven't discovered that much talent, to tell you the truth, because I was busy just making music. But when you hear a voice like Celine Dion, like, you'd have to be an idiot not to know, provided that's the kind of music you like, you'd have to be an idiot not to know that that she's one of the greatest singers that ever hit this planet. I mean,
I will say, though, Allison, and to David's comment about Celine Dion, there's this magical moment in this footage that David had that we were so lucky to get, that's in the film, where when he does it, when he brings her, Celine, into the recording studio for the first time, she hits this note that's, of course, ridiculous. It's before the All By Myself note, but she hits this note, and David's in the studio in the control booth and reacts and goes, oh my God, that's unbelievable. And her reaction, a young Celine Dion, is, really?
Yeah,
she can't believe it, and she can't believe it's him. And is that moment between the two of them, and you watch an audience react to that, and to me it still gives me goosebumps. I grew up in Montreal, I know them, and it still gives me goosebumps to see that relationship between David and Celine.
Barry, what's the equivalent of that for you as a filmmaker on this film? The moment in either an interview or watching some footage where the rest of the world blocked out and it just became all about that moment?
Well, you know, for me, you want a certain intimacy, even though there's six cameras, even though David is a showman. I needed to somehow create a sense of connection and electricity between us. And so in the studio, I don't use notes, which I think threw David a little bit. I kept staring at him. He had to keep eye contact with me. As annoying as that is, I sadly don't look like him. But there was a moment where I played back the Whitney Houston song, I Will Always Love You, in the studio, and in that incredible studio space at Capitol Records. And he just sort of put his head down and got lost in that track, which he's heard a billion times, and got lost in it again, and I got lost in it with him. And it's my favorite moment in the film, because it's just, there's such a sense of purity in watching him connect with something that happened so long ago, including an artist that's gone, tragically. It's still, every time I watch the film, it haunts me.
My guests are Barry Averidge and David Foster. We're talking about the new documentary, David Foster, Off the Record. David, we watch you work quite a bit in this film, and it is remarked upon repeatedly that you often ask singers to take it over, another take, another take, and another take. Mm-hmm. What is it you were looking for? What are you trying to get to, even when you're dealing with singers like Barbra Streisand and Celine Dion?
I've said this before, but I'm going to say it again. And every time I go into the studio, my mantra in my head is that I'm going to get a better vocal out of them than anybody ever has or anybody ever will. That's my attitude when I go. And, of course, I don't always succeed, but that's what I'm trying for. So I like to say to singers, if they complain, which is very rare, but sometimes they just go, no, I'm just tired, I don't want to sing anymore. And I actually have said this a few times. I said, look, I don't really want to sit here and listen to you sing that verse four more times either. I'd rather be home right now. But if you sing it before me four more times, I might just get something that you haven't given me yet. So give me the opportunity to have some more options. Because I want to know all the options that are available to me. And just and it literally has happened sometimes where they'll just all of a sudden sing a little riff. It doesn't have to be, you know, it can be very subtle. But to me, all those little subtleties make up for a great record.
There is just a hilarious moment in the film where one singer, Jennifer Holliday, is not, she's not having it. let's take a listen. This is a clip from David Foster off the record.
I produced the original Dreamgirls in 1981, I think it was. It was Jennifer Holliday. She came into the studio. She walked in with a fur coat and a dog under each arm. And she walked up to the mic. And I said, okay, Jennifer, let's see what it sounds like. She sang her ass off, just like the show. But we were scrambling in the control room. We weren't ready. We wanted just a run through so that we could get the levels. So at the end of it, I went, great, Jennifer, that was fantastic. We're ready. We got our levels. Let's do one. She put her coat on, grabbed her two dogs, and she said, I only sing the song once. And walked out.
David, what did you learn from that experience?
Well, I mean, we haven't spent a lot of time since then, but she got off on an award show after that and thanked me. So I guess, you know, we had a little tiff about it, but I guess she thought she was on stage or something. And the vocal was spectacular, but the last third of the vocal, if you listen carefully to it, it's all distorted. And, you know, me being the perfectionist that I am, I guess I didn't want a distorted vocal because I knew it was going to get a lot of attention, this song and her, because she's sober. She really created that song. She didn't write it, but she created that moment in the show, and she made the show a hit, in my opinion. But she wasn't having it that day.
So, David, not specifically about Jennifer Holliday, but can you work with someone with whom you don't necessarily connect on an emotional level, but that you have respect for their instrument or you're very interested in their voice and their instrument? Can you work with someone like that?
I can, but it's always, you know, it's a nicer atmosphere if you're getting along, for sure. And for the most part, I've gotten along with everybody. But again, like I've said before, making records is not a democracy. So why am I there? I'm there to help you, the artist, the singer, do a great performance. It's your picture on the cover of the CD, well, when there was CDs. It's your picture out there. You're the one that's going to go out into the world and sing this stuff. So don't hire me and then not use my full potential. I produced a group once, a very famous group, and the lead singer now is solo artist and, like, the most famous in the world, and she's amazing. We came to do the vocals on the song, and she said, I don't want you there for the vocals. I'm like, out of all the things that you could say that you don't want me at, why the vocals? I mean, that's what I do best, in my opinion. She didn't want me there, so she did the vocal without me, and it actually turned out great.
Barry, as you were trying, one thing I noticed about David in the film, and it becomes very clear, is he is always on the move, always doing, always going, always working, always engaging. For you as a filmmaker, what challenges did that pose?
It's the actual opposite. I mean, quite often in dealing with massive celebrities who have crazy schedules that, you know, they're constantly canceling or you're waiting. I mean, with David, David just felt his whole life is on camera, and he would just, you know, agree to insert me wherever, you know, I wanted to go. And, you know, in fact, at one time his team, you know, asked me if I was interested in coming to film his wedding, and I said no. And I don't know if he even knows that, but I figured, you know, it's a personal time
no,
for
I didn't.
Him. What do I, you know, there'll be plenty of footage. What do I need to go and be like the caterer or the wedding planner? Go, move your camera over here, and you'll eat with the people in the back. I mean, nah. I mean, you know, so I said no to that. But he made it, you know, pretty easy, and he never said no. I mean, you know, some of the artists we interviewed, without mentioning names, you know, you can wait for hours until they would walk in or wake up, or, you know, or one of them said, you know, we were sitting there in a hotel for literally 7 hours, and they said, well, you know, he's sleeping. He'll be down soon. What? But, you know, I'm used to that. It's not
Josh
my first
Groban.
Rodeo.
I'm kidding.
No,
he was that darn Josh Groban.
Nice. Yeah, the troublemaker Groban. Before I let you go, you know, in the beginning of the film, obviously it was filmed before everything that's been going on, and you talked a bit about, David, about producing or writing a Broadway show. What's the status of that?
Well, Barry, you know, made that sort of a heavy part of the documentary, and I appreciate that, because that is going to be my next and final round, probably, and I'm working hard at it. I have 3 shows in development. They're not Broadway shows yet. They're just musicals, because they're not on Broadway. But we've assembled 3 really great teams for 3 disparate and unique projects. And it's a big challenge. Making a musical is a team sport. I'm not used to team sports. So it's been quite an adjustment, you know, where the director of the Broadway musical, it really has, you know, a lot of say, and the composers don't. So, but I got some good advice a few years ago. Bill Haber, the producer, told me, he said, you've got to be prepared to throw out your best song. And that really helped me through, because I have, in fact, thrown out my best song, in my opinion, many times. You know,
well,
it's a team sport.
That could be your next release, David Foster's Best Songs You've Never Heard. Come on. There's opportunity there.
Well, I know Sarah Bareilles did that. Sarah Bareilles did that with Waitress.
Yeah, there's opportunity there.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody could.
My guests have been producer, composer David Foster and director Barry Averich. We've been talking about the new documentary, David Foster, Off the Record. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Allison. We're happy to be on Netflix, so I can tell you that. That feels big to me.